असतो मा सद्गमय, तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय, मृत्योर्मा अमृतंगमय। ओम शांति शांति शांति। लीड अस फ्रॉम द अनरियल टू द रियल, फ्रॉम डार्कनेस टू लाइट एंड फ्रॉम डेथ टू इमॉर्टैलिटी। ओम पीस पीस पीस। माय डियर एंड रिस्पेक्टेड स्वामी ब्रह्मरूपानंद जी, स्वामी तत्वज्ञानानंद जी एंड स्वामी आत्मज्ञानानंद जी, of course they call them as Swami A, Swami B, and so I'm in America close to a month now, and this is my first visit. It has simply been beyond my, far beyond my imagination as to the quality of work that is being done here. Such wonderful, sincere aspirants associated with every center. It has been a great blessing, a learning experience for me, so to say. In fact, I often envy some of the Swamis here who are much better off than some of us back home, because basically if you lead a good life, that's enough here. The rest takes care of itself, whereas we have multidimensional work back home. Anyway, that's how the mother has ordained, and that's how we are there. So it has been a very happy trip so far, and this center seems to be even very special because of the close association of devotees and the way Swami Atmagyananji has been blend all of you into one wonderful unit. And it's virtually a mirth of joy here all the time, and it has been a very unique experience. I am very thankful to Swami Atmagyananji. Of course, right in front of me there is a clock. It's a very good thing. Because, you know, but one speaker, he had a clock, right, all right. Then he was going on, and then somebody trying to draw his attention. He said, the clock is here. But then they said, Swamiji, look at the calendar, not the clock. Anyway, it will not be like that because we have to catch a flight. See, this subject, practical Vedanta, is something very, very relevant to all of us. Something which has acquired a very special dimension and importance ever since the advent of the Ramakrishna Vivekananda movement, you can say. Now, when you say practical Vedanta, is there anything called impractical Vedanta? We clearly have to look at it a little closely, because Vedanta, although it covers the entire gamut of Hindu philosophy and different schools, more and more it has come to be identified with Advaita Vedanta. Of course, Vedanta covers all schools, Dvaita, Vasishta, Advaita, Advaita, but more closely it is associated with the idea of Advaita Vedanta. Only from that standpoint, you know, this practical Vedanta acquires a great significance. The reason being, one of the greatest proponents of this Advaita Vedanta, Shankaracharya, he gave a tremendous emphasis to jnana, knowledge. And he clearly said, and to a large extent logically proved also, that work and knowledge cannot go together. Knowledge begins where work ends. That was one of the fundamental doctrines of the Shankara Advaita, the Kevala Advaita as they call it. Now, just as avatar has also come down at different times, depending upon the needs of the society and the times, great acharyas, great teachers also come that way. So Shankaracharya had to give this special emphasis because that was the need of the society at that time. People were indulging in enormous amount of this rituals. Work mainly centered on Selfish gains, like going to heaven, having more wealth, having progeny, for ever so many desires to achieve those ends, people would indulge in enormous amount of karma or action. So he had to come down heavily on that. And he gave the emphasis on jnana. Although Shankaracharya had composed one of the most wonderful devotional hymns one can ever think of, yet if you just go by his philosophy, his doctrine, the way he had marshaled his arguments, the emphasis was clearly on one getting rid of the bondage of work itself, and then only dawn of knowledge is possible. Now that was the need of the time, that's all right. But then, you know, anything when it's overemphasized or after it runs out of the present of the need or the particular context in which it was designed or in which it originated, then that brings about some kind of a distortion or a misunderstanding. Now we have a good number of monks particularly who live in the Himalayas region, which is called Uttarakhand. Now, you know, they would be in their own kutiyas, they would be roaming about, they would do so many things, but whenever you talk to them, they would always talk about the unreality of the world and the reality of the Brahman. But you see, when there is an announcement that today there is going to be a bhandara, it's a special feeding, right from dawn till noon, that would be the only topic that would be discussed. Oh, today there is a bhandara. That Sethji is going to feed. There will be laddu, there will be jilebi, there will be puri and pranami. And so, you know, you see, but if you talk to them, they will light up a dhuni and say, oh, jagat teen kaal mein nahi hai. The world does not exist in three times. So they always talk about Brahma Satya Jagan Mithya. But the Jagat is Mithya for every other purpose except my own body and my own needs. So Swami Vivekananda particularly observed this and he was appalled by this condition. He said there's a tremendous amount of energy that's going waste, that is remaining unutilized. Monks who are capable of tremendous dedication, dedicated action, why not divert it in a proper channel? I am reminded of a very funny story associated with these Uttarakhand monks, because I don't mean any disrespect to them. Amongst them also there are extraordinarily elevated souls, and amongst us also there are many ordinary monks, so it doesn't matter. But you know, just for the sake of, you know, there was one such special feeding day, Bhandara day, and they were giving that day this brown sugar called jaggery. I don't know whether that term is really accepted in American English dictionary, but in India we use it very regularly. It's called jaggery or probably brown sugar. Is it, Maharaj? Now, you know, because the other days, no, they hardly get any delicacy to eat. Even this is considered a great delicacy. From morning, the buzz was, oh, today we are going to get jaggery, 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 jaggery everywhere. So they had to line up. So there were two monks who were living in one hut or hermit, a kutiya as they call it. One had to go away on some business, on some work. So he gave the responsibility to the other to collect his share of this jaggery and keep it in safe custody. So this person went, he stood in the line, ate his share all right, then collected the share of his brother monk who had to go out on some other work. So he collected it in a nice cloth, he brought it, and he tied it to one of the beams in the ceiling, bamboo beams or wooden beam, and he was lying down, he was looking at it. So I was looking at it, the other Swami was not coming. He brought it down, ate a little, again tied it up. Still the other Swami is not coming. So repeating this exercise 4 or 5 times, the whole thing was consumed. Now the other Swami knew in the morning itself that today there is going to be the distribution of this brown sugar. So he came back and said, brother, bhaiya, what happened to my share of brown sugar? Brother, what shall I say? Prapanj uda diya. The world, I have completely wiped out. The world has vanished. So you see, Jagat is mithya. Where is the place for jaggery? So I have vanished it. Why do you worry about this unreality? So you see, this unreality can be a very misleading concept unless we understand it in the right context and very properly. So this Prapanch Udadiya is a very famous. But you know, how all this misunderstanding, how it came about, what is the real origin? So we may have to probably go back a little. The Hindu philosophy or the Vedanta system, it's complete, it's comprehensive. It is all-inclusive. No one is left out. There is no question of high and low in this philosophy. The society, according to the Hindu thought, it has four purusharthas or four essential goals or objectives. They are namely dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. Now they have put the first one, the kind of a point of reference or the point of control or regulation, dharma, that as the first purusharta. Without dharma, your life is absolutely meaningless. There is no life without dharma. Dharma comes from a Sanskrit root, or Maharaji knows, dhru, that dhatu means to uphold, to sustain. So that which is a sustaining principle or the upholding principle or guiding principle of life is this dharma. So as long as you indulge in all the activities of life guided by dharma, you are on safe grounds. You're absolutely all right. So they say, first you keep dharma, stick to your dharma, and then you go to the other purusharthas, namely artha. So according to the Hindu philosophy, acquisition of wealth, becoming rich is not bad, it is not condemned. You can become rich, but you must be guided by dharma in your quest for wealth. Then, kama, desires. You can have desires, you can satisfy your desires, but the rider, the guiding principle, the filter point is dharma. Once you are guided by dharma, you can't do anything under the formula, go as you like. You have to be guided, you have to follow the dictates of the guiding principle, and you will be again safe. So, there is a regulation. And finally, moksha or liberation, the ultimate goal of life. Moksha is total freedom, freedom from all bondage, all bonds, all restrictions, all hurdles, anything that limits you, go beyond that, that is a freedom. A brief word about this freedom itself, we can have one more full lecture on that if Maharaj invites me again. Now, this freedom, you know, freedom, why freedom? What is this moksha? Let us not go into the philosophical nitty-gritties. Let us try to understand it in a very simple way. All of us constantly seek freedom. We are ever after freedom. From the time we are born, from the time we are aware, till the last day of life. One quest of life is freedom. But what is the freedom all of us want? We want to be free from old age. People want to be eternally young. People want to have unlimited amount of wealth. We want to be free from the hassles of interpersonal relationship. In ever so many directions, wherever we turn our eyes, we experience a lack of freedom or hurdles or difficulties or obstacles. Our struggle, the only struggle of life, is to be free from this or that, one lack of freedom to another lack of freedom. It keeps on, you know, going in that vicious circle, as they call it. What happens? Supposing you feel that you don't have enough wealth or enough money, you are not free from the want of money or wealth, and you want to augment it by working more, spending more time. You want to be free from that lack of freedom, but you end up losing some other freedom. Namely, the interpersonal relationship suffers. The family complains, oh, you don't spend time at all. What is the point of your earning? Or you work so much, whatever you earn, much more than that goes in your medical treatment, thereby you lose the freedom of health. So in the world, all our search for freedom seems to be running after a mirage, and we seem to be only going from one lack of freedom to another and not getting hold of freedom as such. That is why Vedanta says, you attempt that freedom which would in one go remove all your limitations, all your lack of freedom, that they call as moksha. That freedom which would take you beyond all wants, all hurdles, all restrictions, you will not feel any bondage, any limitation whatsoever, that they call as ultimate freedom or moksha. It's something, you know, to give a pragmatic example. No, we are all practical people. Supposing you have a monthly salary of, say, $20,000. I hope many of you get that much. Now, supposing we set apart $2,000 for rent, $2,000 for partying, $2,000 for some subscription, like that you keep on allocating, then you find, you know, you can't spend more in a particular area because then it will be cutting into some other budget. So you have to confine. Supposing, you know, some very rich person, say Rockefeller or somebody, has left a huge fortune for you. You have an unlimited bank account and you are given a book, you can sign as many checks as you want, then you don't have to plan like that. Whenever you need to spend, you just have to issue a check. Like that, they say this one freedom would take care of all your other limitations, problems and bondages. That's why they say the goal of life is moksha or freedom. Correspondingly, they've also divided the life into four stages, namely brahmacharya ashrama, garhastha ashrama, vanaprastha ashrama and sannyasa ashrama. You see, life was never considered unholy or something to be looked down upon. Every stage of life is an ashrama. It's like temple, something worshipful, something extremely sacred and holy. The student life is called brahmacharya. When you live a greatly restricted, regulated life, then you are allowed to become a householder or a grihastha. Then you slowly withdraw from activities, you become a vanaprasthin, or you retire to forests or this or that, or you be free from activities. Then you go to sannyasa, or the highest goal of life, namely you give up everything. Now, this is the normal division. But the Vedas themselves have given sanction for even a quicker approach to the ultimate goal of life. They say there are two paths essentially in this world. Vidohi vedokta dharmaha, pravritti lakshananche nivritti lakshananche. Twofold path, twofold approach to the ultimate goal of life. One is called pravritti, the other is called nivritti. Pravritti means externalization, activities, going through the experiences of life. And nivritti is contemplation, inwardness, meditation, complete cessation or withdrawal from any action or activities. They never said that nivritti is superior to pravritti. Twofold approach. You can go this way or you can go that way. Now, what is the difference? Many of you might have gone, or if you go to India, you can see there is a very famous place of pilgrimage dedicated to Lord Shiva called Amarnath. That's deep in the Himalayas at quite a height. There is an ice, natural formation of ice Shivalinga, and people go on a trek. Now, there is a normal traditional route by which it takes 4 days for you to reach that Shivalinga. That's called the normal route. There's a shortcut called Baltal. To that, in one day, you can go and come down. But the thing is, it's extremely tough climb, steep, very difficult. Not possible for elderly people or those who have arthritis, other difficulties or this. So, you know, either you go by the normal circuitous route, which takes you 4 days, or if you are very strong, you are deeply determined, you want to go immediately and have darshan of Shiva, go via the shortcut or the tough route. Similarly, pravritti and nivritti are like that. Pravritti is that where you go, wend your way slowly up the mountain without feeling the gradient or the slope, slowly you go up and up and up. The other is where you take the shortcut because you're in a hurry. You have seen through the transitory nature of this earthly existence, even at a very young age. Sri Ramakrishna used to give many examples. He says, boys like Narendra, Rakha, they're all Nitya Siddhas, born free. World can never touch them. From birth, they are free, ever free, born free. Like that, you know, there are some, even may not be born free, still from a very young age, they have realized that there is a greater purpose. Their one goal is that ultimate freedom. They go headlong into it, even from a very young age. So they go along the path of Nibriti. The others, yes, you become a student, you become a grihastha, you become vanaprastha, but goal is same. They never said that pravritti margis will have everlasting enjoyment, nivritti margis will have only a renunciation and tyaga and austerities. No. The goal for both is same, namely moksha, liberation. But in one case, you can take a winding path and go slowly, the other you can. See, Sri Ramakrishna gives a very beautiful example in that book, Kathamrita, that we discussed the other day. He says there is a beautiful temple dedicated to Mother Annapurna in Varanasi. It is close to that Vishwanath temple. Vishwanath temple is the more famous one. But in Annapurna temple, from morning to evening, they feed the pilgrims. So Sri Ramakrishna used to say, you will get your food all right, prasad all right from Annapurna temple. But if you're hungry, you must go and stand in the line right in the morning. So you can have in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, depending upon your hunger. So depending upon your spiritual hunger, your thirst for the ultimate goal of life, you can go via either the pravritti marga or the nivritti marga. Now what happened over a period of time? You know, all of us suffer from this very common disease called forgetfulness. So people over a period of time started forgetting the pravritti margis. They thought that our goal is everlasting enjoyment. More and more they started tending towards enjoyment and indulgence in sense-related activities. And slowly, these two became two different paths with two different goals altogether. So, Hindu philosophy, Hindu idea of life, as I said, is a comprehensive, all-inclusive life. There's no higher low. The goal is same. Suddenly you find, even amongst the Hindus, one set of people, a larger and a larger number, the majority, tending towards enjoyment, and a small microscopic minority tending towards this complete cessation of activities or nibriti or meditation or contemplation. That is why in the Hindu concept, the need for avatara, God to come down on earth in a human form again and again. So somebody might ask, particularly those who belong to other religions, why? God came, he gave the message, that is enough. Where is the need for God to come down again and again? This exactly is the need. God comes down on earth in human form, lives amongst human people, sets in motion a new ideal, a new approach. The goal is same, the ultimate truths, values are ever same in Hindu philosophy or Hindu religion. But the approach, the way, that changes according to the needs of the time. That is why, again and again, an avatara comes, he sets in motion a new way, people follow it, they are going ahead, slowly this forgetfulness comes in, dust starts gathering, and then some of the values are forgotten. Then when, as I said, you know, life is completely guided by dharma, opposite to that is adharma. When there is more and more indulgence in sense-related activities, the adharma scale becomes stronger and more weightier. Then there is an imbalance in the world. Dharma seems to be going down and down. That is why to re-establish dharma, a new avatara again comes. It's what in Gita it is said, Eda eda hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata, abhyuttanam adharmasya tadatmanam, parittaranaya sadhunam, vinashayata dushkritam, dharma samsthapanarthaya sambhav. So, to re-establish dharma again and again. So the Lord has to come down. So when they saw that this pravritti marga is being completely ignored, it's not being considered as a way or approach to the ultimate goal, then there was a need for again restating these values, the principles, and making that extremely relevant. So in my humble opinion, one of the greatest contributions of this Ramakrishna Vivekananda movement or philosophy is this bridging of the gap between these two margas, making it more inclusive. You see, if you go to a traditional mutt in India, you will have to sit at least 100 feet away from the pontiff and salute him from a distance. Now here you say, hi, yay, and put your hands on his shoulders. Now this type of closeness, why? There is a philosophy behind it, not that we wish to socialize or we are bringing down the ideas. The one emphasis of Ramakrishna Vivekananda, a special contribution, is to again establish the integral way of life of Hinduism itself and bring into focus more and more how together so much of good can be done, where it will result in the benefit of the individual as well as the community or the society. So that is why, you know, there is a very important anecdote in Sri Ramakrishna's life. So Swami Vivekananda, that's why again and again he said, you know, the idea according to Hinduism, according to Vedanta was, we have nothing to do with the world, we retire into the forest, we contemplate on the Brahman or the Supreme Truth, we are lost to the world. A very minority, maybe 0.001% or whatever it is, of the population. Swamiji said, no. The principles of Vedanta, I wish to bring them from the forest to the marketplace, to daily life. That's why somewhere he said, my monks would this moment dive deep into meditation and the next moment would go and sell the produce in the market. He said, I do not believe in a religion or a god which cannot wipe out the tears of a widow or bring a morsel of food to the mouth of an orphan. He wanted a complete all-inclusive religion. All-inclusive religion is not something to be practiced for just a fragment or a small moment of our everyday life, but should become a continuous activity, part and parcel of our daily life at all times. I cannot say 2 minutes I am religious and rest of the time I am irreligious. That was the old idea. Do whatever you like. Go and give some pranami in the temple, all your sins are washed out. No, it's not going to happen that way. So Sri Ramakrishna's life also, you know, even the compiler, Mahendranath Gupta, he told him, no, what is it we have to worship? Images. Should we not tell people that they are only stone and they should not be mistaken for God? Sri Ramakrishna became extremely irritated. Oh, you Calcutta people, you are always busy about teaching others. What about you? Then he said, why made of mud or clay? It's Chaitanya, it's consciousness. So his whole life was, you know, it was spent in this integration. One of his very favorite disciples, who later became Swami Turiyananda, Hari as he was called. Hari was coming, you know, to Sri Ramakrishna. And suddenly he stopped. Sri Ramakrishna heard that he was deeply engrossed in the study of Vedanta. Then, you know, Sri Ramakrishna, he had a very unique way of keeping the flock together. Whenever he would go to Calcutta, any to nearby place, he would send for others who are in the living close by, so that, you know, they can all have his satsanga, holy company. So he had gone to Calcutta, he sent for this Hari. When this Hari came, he asked him, Hari, I hear you are deeply engrossed in the study of Vedanta. Of course, Ramakrishna perhaps wanted to tell him, why do you go to the books instead of coming to the living Vedanta? Why not learn from life? Because he was humbler than a blade of grass, he would never have uttered such words, you know, by hint. But he asked him, Acha, what does your Vedanta say? Does it not say that Brahman alone is real and the world is unreal? So Hari was stunned. What I have been trying to gather by poring over volumes and volumes of Vedanta, this person just comes and sums up in a few words. But Sri Ramakrishna was very quick to draw his attention to that kind of a discrimination analysis or vichara. He said, but you see, even your idea that the world is unreal, how do you get it? For that purpose, you have to look upon everything else, whatever you deal with. You have to say, this is unreal, this is unreal, this book, this stairs, this furniture, this man, this everything, all these are unreal. So your vichara, your unreality also depends upon all that. So how can you ignore that? If they were not to be there, where will be your vichara? What is the premise? What is the ground? For your purpose of understanding that Brahman alone is real and the world is unreal, that part of logic or analysis, you have to draw only from the world, your daily experience. Perhaps there he was hinting that you cannot completely ignore and negate it. He gave a wonderful lifeline to all of us. You see, every day we are in an extremely busy world. We are so involved in activities. Supposing, you know, everything, we have to constantly think that my whole life is unreal. How do you transcend from the unreal to the real? It's not good to get attached, to be involved and become that, degrade ourselves that way. But at the same time, no, we should have a proper outlook. So he gave a different idea, different interpretation to the world itself. So you know, if everything, if you have to negate as unreal, even our sadhana becomes unreal. You sit, you try to do japa, you try to do meditation, everything comes under the realm of unreality only. So what is real then? So Sri Ramakrishna gave a wonderful new idea, a new concept. He brought into operation a new idea called vijnana, which transcends even jnana. In fact, you know, when Swamiji, at the time it was Narendranath, Sri Ramakrishna asked him, "Acha, please tell me, what do you want?" He said, "I want to remain deeply immersed in samadhi all the time, and then come out a bit now and then to have a morsel of food, and then again dive deep into samadhi." Any other guru would have jumped with joy at this disciple's intent or his desire. But Sri Ramakrishna was not happy. He scolded him. "What a narrow-minded person you are. I thought that you would become a huge banyan tree under the shade of which thousands of scorched souls would take shelter. You are thinking of your own mukti or liberation." Then he said, "Don't you sing that song? Whatever is there." No, there's a very famous Hindi song. "Jo kuch hai, so tu hi hai. Whatever is you see as manifest, it's all only the Lord." He said, "There is a state greater than samadhi." That is exactly what he had himself told in several other places, based on his own life experience, what is called the state of vijnana. What is that? Briefly. You know, he says, you climb up a flight of stairs. When you go up, you keep on, because your idea is to go and reach the terrace. When you climb up, you keep on negating, "The steps are not this terrace, the steps are not the terrace, the steps are not the terrace." Once you reach the terrace, you know you have reached the goal. And then when you come down, at that time, you don't kick or dismantle or smash the steps, but you come down with the awareness that the steps are also made up of the same material as the terrace, namely the bricks, mortar, cement, etc. So that gives you, when you were above, when before reaching the goal, there was ignorance, there was the understanding that all these are all not terrace, that is also true. But once you reach the terrace, once you come down with a greater awareness, because you have already tasted the highest realization. When you come down with a greater realization, namely, it becomes more integral. You are able to accommodate everything. Nothing is out of you. The whole world is defined. Every experience, whatever you see, nothing, you don't have to discard or negate anything. Make your life all-inclusive. At one point of time, he could not walk on a blade of grass because he saw it was throbbing with consciousness. Two boatmen were fighting at a distance of about 100 feet. One landed a huge blow on the back of the other. He simply shrieked in pain, and there's a huge mark on his back. Then his nephew asked him, "Uncle, who did it to you?" Sri Ramakrishna had no words because his consciousness was one with the entire humanity. He was going through the streets of Calcutta. he saw people drunk and they were in a tipsy condition, but he did not saw them as drunkards. He saw that they are having that extraordinary ananda or bliss. He saw fallen women in the streets of Calcutta. Oh, Divine Mother, you want to show me this face of yours? So in his life, everything was, you know, all-inclusive, comprehensive. Nothing was left out. So that's why he said, the world is a play or leela, manifestation of God. So, you know, you can have a different world view to whatever you do, whatever you practice, all your activities, all your efforts. Everything can be given a different drift or a different direction. So, you know, that is how Sri Ramakrishna taught. More importantly, this particular idea of transforming work, giving it a different dimension. Probably, you know, one very important incident occurred in Sri Ramakrishna's room. One day he was explaining to those assembled about the important three tenets of Vaishnava religion. And he said, one is taste for the Lord's name. Then when he said, compassion to living beings, jivas, he went into samadhi. When he came down, he said, from the transcendental state, when he came down to a little of the normal consciousness, he said, what is it I am talking? Who are you? Such an insignificant creature. Can you show compassion? No. Looking upon jivas, human beings, as veritable manifestations of the Lord and serve them. You see, here you get a clue as to how to make your practical Vedanta very effective. You can work, you can function, you can do many things in the world, but provided your attitude, your approach, the way you do, that is extremely important. If you have the right attitude, you can convert every activity of yours into something very ennobling. It's much easier perhaps when you come and do in an ashrama. What I'm saying, supposing, you know, let us take it a very small practical example. So you are working for a big corporate. Now what we think normally, oh, we are working so hard, the cream, all the profits, they go to the shareholders or the owners, they take away everything, we slog, we don't get our dues, we don't get our recognition. No end to our lamentations. Now this is the unenlightened worldview. What is practical Vedanta? The enlightened worldview is, yes, I'm here. There is a joy. I'm contributing. Maybe someone is taking a bigger share of the cake. Maybe he's more hungry. Let him take. But I'm happy to let the other man have it. But I am contributing. Because you know that ultimately through that corporation, thousands and thousands of families are served. You are also part of that great yajna or sacrifice where you participate in the well-being of a large section of humanity. So, you know, every activity, every work can be given a different dimension. If you look at it, that would bring you tremendous peace, satisfaction, that would make your life more and more integral and whole. That's what Swamiji was. When he established this Ramakrishna mission, his idea was the monks, they would work for their own evolution, all right. Atmano mokshartam, goal, mukti, liberation, yes. At the same time, they cannot neglect or they cannot ignore the other aspect, namely jagat hita or the welfare of the world. So he wanted a balance. So again and again he would emphasize. In fact, even to that extent, he would tell some of his disciples, you have spent so many of your lives searching for your own liberation. Why not give one life in the service of others? So, you know, it is possible. This is the extraordinary contribution, you can say, of this Ramakrishna Vekanta, the tradition of giving a different, entirely world view. And you know, these were demonstrated clearly by Sri Ramakrishna, Holy Mother, Swamiji, the other disciples, even monks down the line. Now, Sri Ramakrishna, if you see, at least towards the last days of his life on earth, he was suffering from an excruciating, painful cancer. But he would not stop. Day and night, he would talk of God. His one passion, one goal was how to awaken in people a little of that Godward drift, The love for God, love for the ultimate, transcendence. Doctor would come and say, you should not talk, your throat is so damaged. And that very doctor would talk for 3 hours. Because, you know, his presence was contagious. Everybody would feel uplifted. And his one goal was to awaken as many souls as possible. Holy Mother, morning 4 o'clock to night 11 o'clock, unending labor. Had she been in America, she would have got some few thousand dollars per day. That amount of hard work, how was it possible? They say she used to do 100,000 mantras every day. Foolishly, I was trying to sit and calculate one day. I found it takes about 15 to 16 hours. If a person has to work for 16 or 18 hours a day, how does she get? After all, 24 hours is same for everyone. The point is, she had reached such a state, the pravritti and nivritti, the inwardness and external activity, had so coalesced into such a wonderful blend. Even as she was indulging in external activity, there was a spontaneous repetition of the mantra or the japa. That is all she could do a lakh, probably. There was no other explanation how it was possible for anyone to do 100,000 japa a day, unless there was a mechanism by which it would go on completely involuntarily. That's possible because she had completely erased the gap or the difference between these two approaches. That's why in the introduction to complete work, Sannivedita wrote, henceforth, no more distinction between the sacred and the secular. Everything is sacred. Nothing called secular. Holy Mother's birthday, during her lifetime, that was being celebrated in Jayarambate, big halla going on, big noise, people lining up for pranam. Holy Mother is not to be found. She's deep inside the kitchen, preparing diet for one of the daughter-in-laws of the house who was expecting a baby. How was it possible? Unless she was completely established in this idea of practical Vedanta. Everyone, Swamiji, those days, with Mike, I have to take tea every 3-4 hours to keep my throat all right. No facilities. Audience of 300, 400. His lectures used to be for 2 hours, 3 hours, and in the same day, 3-4 lectures. Actually, America is a blessed country because he gave his blood, life blood for America. His best he gave to America. What was only leftover, as you call it, that was what we got in India. So, that is practical Vedanta. A person who was a dhyana siddha from birth, giving up his great tendency for a meditative life to serve humanity, this is practical Vedanta. Swami Akhandanaji, another great soul, gave up everything, started the first orphanage with one child. And today you go and see what a magnificent institution has come up. What tradition. A knower of Brahman, day and night busy with not children from very cultured or very rich families, street children who had nowhere to go, that kind of children. He was dealing with them day and night, bringing them up like mother. How was it possible? Unless he was completely rooted in that idea. Even his last words, you know, message, at the deathbed, such a kind of a person, you talk about Thakur or Brahman or the highest, that's what some of the other disciples like Brahmananda and others talked about. He said, I don't want anything. The only thing I pray for is at least more and more people are relieved from their misery, dukkha. So, you know, this is the idea of practical Vedanta, whereby you function with an enlightened worldview, where you can integrate all your activities. But you know, it comes not just like that. We have to very assiduously, seriously sit down, think, practice. Whenever we deviate, whenever we have other tendencies, bring the mind back. Constantly, if you do, the great truth lies hidden in this message of Sri Ramakrishna Mother and Swamiji, that it's possible to look at the entire world, the creation, Yes, that's also a worldview, that everything, when do you realize that? See, the point is, even you need a good starting point. When we are in a different condition, Sri Ramakrishna again tells you, you know, you are pricked by a thorn. It's paining. You are saying, no, I'm not bothered. Nothing has happened. No, that is not correct. You must understand, you know, the wandering monk had come to Dakshineswar. He was leading a questionable life, but he was talking, oh, the world, it is not existing in the three kalas, in the three times. But Sri Ramakrishna has spit upon that Vedanta. You must realize where you are. Swamiji also said, you have to go from lower truth to higher truth. So where we are, if you have to accept our present condition and proceed accordingly towards the ultimate goal of life, namely mukti or liberation, one of the most potent or wonderful ways of doing this is through this idea of practical Vedanta. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tatsat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu. I deliberately closed it because I wanted to give you an opportunity in case you want to ask some questions, because no, those who are constantly with you can't take this liberty, because then they have no escape. But whereas, you know, whether I answer or not, I'm going to take the flight. So it's okay for me. So in case you have anything to ask, if you have any question, otherwise we have closing song and then we disperse. Yes. Then we take it that we are all in complete agreement. Yes.
I was just wondering, according to your breadth of experience and your thoughtful analysis of all these issues with practical Vedanta, what would you suggest is the best tool to not avoid but rather fight off temptation?
Yeah, the point is, you know, when we have a different outlook on the world itself, will you defile something which we consider sacred? Giving way to temptation is amounting to that. Defiling, disrespecting. See, even everything, you know, the body which has been given to us, that is sacred. God has given. Any indulgence, temptations usually, they come that way. They prompt you, goad you into excesses, indulgence. Anything that is normally not rightfully due to us. That's what really tempts us that way. You take your breakfast, lunch, dinner, no one calls, you are succumbing to temptation. So whatever we go out of the way. That's why I said essentially the idea of dharma, guiding principle. You must set for yourself. What is going to guide me? How am I going to live? First of all, you know, that is why we should at least have an idea of what we have to seek in this life. Then you have to build the way according to that. Once you have, yes, right now I am far away from that, but I have understood this. This is the goal of my life. This is how I am going to proceed. When you go along the way, then you can devise your path, methodology. Whenever you digress, you can bring it back. Yes, temptations will be there, because whenever, as long as we are bound by this body, the mind and the senses, temptations will be there. But there's nothing to fear, nothing to worry. Again, one thing is being goal-minded. Not only that, that's why one of the very powerful weapons which Sri Ramakrishna talks about is the company of the holy. When we are alone, we struggle, we succumb. Come, rush to Swami A, come to Vedanta Center. Be in the company of like-minded people. Yes, I'm coming to you. So that, you know, you have there's a kind of a safety wall. Supposing you feel like, you know, indulging in heavy drinking, come here. Have a cup of tea with Swami and spend your time. After 1 hour, it will be gone. Now, I'm really telling you, honestly, or be in the company of such friends. Select. Satsanga is so important for all of us, even for monks, for everyone, company of the holy. When the mind digresses, when it wants to go the forbidden path, we have to be in such company so that they will hold us back and prevent us from going astray in that way. But of course, you know, Sri Ramakrishna, Mother and Swamiji, they are so tolerant. They will just guide you, help us, to look upon you as their own child, and you will get all the protection. But certain basic ground rules have to be set, and then the rest of the journey, yes. There will be many others struggling along with you, helping you. There will be co-travelers, there will be others. You will never be alone as long as your goal and your company, etc., are organized that way.
Swami, you talked about the role of the individual in the corporation. As you know, if you take it to a broader global level, there is this competition between socialism and capitalism, China versus India, for example. So do you think that Vedanta, or a person who is involved in the Vedantist, is more consistent with one or the other of these philosophies, or is it consistent with both?
See, the point is, you know, quite often we are worried about everything else except ourselves. Please focus the mind on your needs. We cannot think for the entire world. Whatever suits people, let them take. But what is your view? What is your goal? Spiritual life is so subjective, so centered on oneself. We cannot be, what can be the American policy? What should be their foreign policy, whether it is based on Vedanta or not? That can't be our concern. See, the world will go on in its own way. The world is made, chaos is the order of the world. It has been created that way. Nobody can set it right. That's why Swamiji clearly said, do not think that even for a moment that the world is in the least need of you. By chance, by accident, we are here. Our business is to get out, seek our goal, seek our mukti, seek our liberation. If you feel you are bound, seek the remedies. Otherwise, you can also float along with the crowd and be happy. So it is not possible to see, they're all irrelevant, totally beside the point. China today, it is what it is. What it was some years back. Was it correct or was this correct? Chinese are debating every day. They are not sure. So there is nothing like right or wrong in these things. As long as we focus on our individual life, that's why spiritual life is very subjective, completely centered on the individual. As long as we are focused, that is how we can do. We cannot have a global policy for Vedanta or Mukti that way. Yes, yes. No introduction. Every question is important.
Swami Akhandananda and Swami Vivekananda, all of them, they could see the consciousness in
yes.
others and serve them. But
yes, yes. No, it's okay. I have understood. See, that is what, you know, the Gita clearly says, Yadyat Acharati Sreshaha Tattayeva Itaro Janaha Sayat Pramanam Kurite Lokas Tadanuvartate. What the great minds, what great people have done, the ordinary minds, ordinary people imitate. They try to do. Today you may not see, but if you consistently practice, after some years you will see that. It's possible. What they have done is to show us the way. You behave this way, you attempt it this way, you will get it. To give us that certainty, that assurance, they do that way. Yes.
So I like one practical tool you gave about company, which we do every Sunday, and in reference to indulgence versus necessity. But I also have very severe disease, forgetfulness, which you also mentioned. The dividing line between, the invisible dividing line between the need and greed, how do you apply karma to that when you say everything's subjective? At what point do you say, okay, I'm going from need to greed and I should beat myself?
Yeah, I've understood. See, the point is, you know, again, the whole thing, you know, everything is centered on our thirst for the ultimate goal. The more and more you are drawn towards it, Sri Ramakrishna says, the more and more you walk towards it, the best automatically recedes. It goes away. See, the more and more you are interested in the ultimate, you will find the other things drop off. What was once a great necessity or need today, it would look like a greed for you. So unless we evolve, it is not possible to draw the dividing line, and which would never be same. It will keep shifting positions depending upon our own inner evolution. So the goal is to evolve, and see, it's a question of always, you know, the hen versus the egg. It will become like that, a never-ending, you know, vicious circle. Simultaneously, you must do. Simultaneously, try to cut down. At same time, go towards the goal. You find that more and more you become refined. Inwardly, the more and more you start growing, the other thing takes a backseat. That's why, you know, you find the difference. You know, there are devotees here also, I'm sure, in Delhi. For them, there is no other entertainment in the world except coming to the ashrama. You may call them fools, you may call them impractical people, you can call them unsocial. But you know, once you set your goals, we should be honest and work accordingly. Authenticity is so important in spiritual life. Yes. The beginning of the end.
Huh? And this is my understanding of Srivindi Thakur. We find that he's saying Yuga Dharma is Bhakti Yoga, right? And Karma Yoga is not for everyone. Maybe Shalimukundi can do it, right? And Swamiji is more about Karma Yoga. Shiva Ganaji Moshe, like you said, right? And Bhakti, of course, at least in my experience, is a little bit safer because we're not in the midst of all that stuff. We're kind of protecting ourselves and in the temple.
Okay, so I have understood. So you feel which way you should go, or?
Yeah, how do you know which way is? I guess it's a personal issue, but how do you know if Karma Yoga is good for us or not, or it's going to be harmful?
You see, Dabha, first of all, one basic premise is, no yoga is independent of all other yogas. In every yoga, there is an intermingling of other yogas. But what predominates, it gets that name. So, no one can say, I will do only one yoga. So, when they spoke about, they talked only about the dominant aspect of the particular yoga. So, this, you know, one has to decide according to one's own temperament or preferences. See, whatever be the yoga, you know, fix the goal. Once the goal is fixed, you can change tracks. You can even combine a little of that, blend a little of that, depending upon. Once we are sure, this is what we have to do, then it's possible. Even if you go a little, Thakur himself says, he himself will show you. Even if you take a wrong path, he will correct it. What we basically need is that supreme sincerity. For example, in Karma Yoga, when Swamiji says, Karma Yoga is not possible without deep devotion or bhakti. How do you do Shiva Jnana Jeev Seva? How can you look upon the person in front of you of God unless you are extremely worshipful, unless you have deep devotion? It demands a devotion of the highest order to be a true Karma Yogi. In Bhakti Yoga, you cannot say, I will only do stotra part. Who will do all that pasting, sandal paste, picking up flowers, and then arranging offerings? Everyone will do, I will only do the final thing. That is not Bhakti Yoga. Bhakti Yoga is also, what is the most important component of Bhakti Yoga according to the Vaishnavas? Kainkarya, Seva. Seva to the Lord, Seva to the devotees also, not only to the Lord. So there is no escape. Once you accept the ultimate goal, you will be dragged in this way or that way. So accordingly you can have a little more of this, a little more of that, depending upon your temperament. But only it's a naming. Each person has emphasized a particular aspect depending upon a particular situation. So we have to decide and then pursue accordingly. Of course, Ramakrishna never liked anyone being one-sided. He always used to advocate. And Swamiji also said, if you are to be cast in the mold of Sri Ramakrishna, you should be equally good in all the yogas that way. But we can select what predominantly appeals to our mind, to our temperament, and then proceed. Thing is, we have to start the journey. That's most important. Thank you.